Karen, do you want to come to see?
All right, thank you. You know, it's an honor for me to be here as part of this panel. Some very impressive presentations beforehand. This is largely going to be a descriptive presentation to you. Karen and I will be speaking to you. We actually just got back from Gaza about 2 days ago, and we've been going regularly over the last several years through Washington Physicians for Social Responsibility as part of a medical delegation. And so this talk will largely exist around the impacts on healthcare in an area that is currently under siege and has had the impact of war. And it's going to focus on two case studies, one of a condition that is not directly caused by the war and the siege in Gaza, but is certainly the care of which is directly impacted by it, and then another condition which is directly related to the war and siege and whose care is affected by it as well. So my part of this talk will be on a disorder of sex differentiation. And to understand this in the setting of Gaza, first you need to understand the underlying healthcare delivery system there. This is a public-private mix. There's one public hospital in the Gaza Strip, which is about 135 square miles, in Gaza City that provides all the specialty care and a lot of the primary care. It's available to all the citizens in Gaza, which is about 1.5 million people, care of which in that setting is felt to be beyond the knowledge of the physicians, gets sent out, if at all possible, to either the rest of the occupying territories, Egypt, and rarely to Egypt, to the United States, Australia, or Europe. This is a close-up picture of Al Shifa Hospital, which is the major public hospital in Gaza City, and you can actually see some of the bullet holes in the top of the hospital from some of the previous conflicts. Now, because of the unmet need of these people, there are a number of private NGO hospitals that are largely between about 25 to 50 beds that exist through the Gaza Strip. We actually worked in Al Auda Hospital, which is north in Jabalia, which is one of the refugee camps in public aid, or Ma'ama Hospital, which is down in Gaza City itself. In those systems, the patients are expected to pay often at a discounted rate, but they are expected to bear some of the cost of the care. So there are a number of pressures that get applied to this type of a system, and this private-public mix is fairly common in resource-limited areas. For one, about 65% of the people in Gaza live in a condition of poverty. There's really a limited educational resources to the healthcare providers there, especially in regarding training for tertiary care, which is something that I do as a pediatric urologist. In addition, the infrastructural resources, largely non-durable goods, are in short supply, as well as durable goods, including things like operating room equipment. So specialization is such a scarcity there because it remains difficult for the providers who want to focus in this area to get out for further training, and it is difficult for healthcare providers who want to get into the Gaza Strip to go in and actually provide this type of education. Now, ironically enough, the primary care system in Gaza is well developed, and that's because of the impact of the United Nations, as well as the previous occupying forces of Israel itself, in doing an excellent job building a primary care infrastructure. Another pressure on the system is the medical record system, which is a paper-based system which comes to us in a mixture of Hebrew, Arabic, and English. The family controls the medical record, which they typically bring in plastic bags to you, and then it kind of gets dumped on the desk and you sort through it to figure out what kind of care they've had. So it ends up being a really fragmented way to provide medical care. Now, for those patients who want to get out of the system or who attempt to, this gets done through one organizing body. And in fact, I've been told there's one woman who actually reviews all the applications. They go to a medical panel. The process is tedious and can take months at a time. Once you make your way through that, then you have to go through the exit procedure, which going through the Eretz border of Israel means two checkpoints and in itself can take hours. And includes a fairly extensive security check. If you make it through that process, then you can actually get on an ambulance and you go to the occupied territories to get further specialty care. Now, what does this have to do with a condition like 17-beta-hydroxysteroid dehydrogenase 3 deficiency? So this is an autosomal recessive trait, so it's an inherited condition, and what happens when you have this autosomal recessive trait, which you've inherited from both parents, is as a male, it masculinizes the genitalia, feminizes the genitalia, and then at puberty, with the testosterone surge, that feminized genitalia undergoes partial masculinization. And this is because of a defect, enzymatic defect, in the steroid biosynthesis pathway, which you can see blocks the conversion of androstenedione to testosterone and then dihydrotestosterone. And this is important because, if you remember, in utero, we're born gender neutral. So depending on the hormonal environment which we live in, essentially this aquatic environment, if you are exposed to testosterone and dihydrotestosterone at that time, the external genitalia masculinizes. If you're not exposed to that hormone or hormones, then the genitalia feminizes. Because of the impact, specifically in the Gaza Strip, there's a high incidence of this condition. In Jabalia, which has one of the highest population densities in the world, there's limited mobility. So this condition, which is typically 1 in 147,000 people throughout the world, occurs at about a rate of 1 in 200 to 300, which is about a 100-fold increased incidence. And that's due to significant intermarriage. Property inheritance laws, as well as social customs, allow for the marriage of first cousins to first cousins, and there's limited mobility, so there's limited access to marriageable partners, and it's increased the impact of this inherited trait. So what this looks like on the ground when you're there is these families come in, and you'll have 3, 4, 5 boys in a family that are affected by this. Oftentimes, a associative trait is this blonde hair, which is quite unusual in this otherwise fairly Arabic Semitic population. And then the external genitalia, as you can see here, are this is one that's, I would say, clearly ambiguous. Some of them look much more feminized. So this is a little boy. He's 46XY by his genotype. And you can see here he has this clitoral phallus and a distal vaginal development. So you can imagine reconstruction of this takes advanced surgical and medical skills, which currently are not readily available in the Gaza Strip, not because of the lack of interest. When I go to train the physicians who are there, there's a large level of interest, but they're limited by medical education, they're limited by the OR resources that are available to them. And in addition to this, you can imagine that families with this concern also have needs for psychological support. In fact, in a developed country like the United States, all these families and the patients receive that level of care. Gaza Strip, there's one child psychiatrist available for the 1.5 million people who are there, and that individual, as you'll hear from Kara as part of the talk, is already saturated with needs around traumatic stress. So we're going to go on to talk about the next part of the talk here.
My name is Kara Motion. I'm a PhD student at the University of Washington in environmental health nursing. My background is as a psychiatric nurse practitioner and also a community health nurse. And as we talk about the current situation in Gaza, it's important to highlight the use of the social ecological model to address continuous traumatic stress. So, when we talk about post-traumatic stress, we also have to look at the environment in which it occurs. So the history of the most recent attack that occurred in Gaza was Operation Cast Lead, where the infrastructure was attacked in addition to the civilians. Homes were destroyed, schools were destroyed, libraries, public libraries were destroyed at the primary school level as well as the university level. Health facilities were destroyed, as well as street infrastructure, making sidewalks not usable, and stoplights not working, and difficulty for navigating the built environment, as well as public spaces unsafe for children to play in, related to half-demolished buildings, as well as other types of contaminants left over from Operation Cast Lead. This impacts the current state of the siege, which creates a situation where it's difficult for healthcare professionals to receive advanced mental health training. It's also a challenge for consultation needs to discuss challenging mental health cases with colleagues, as Rich was talking about, due to lack of resources and mobility in and out, mental health care providers are not able to frequently leave the country to be able to seek additional specialized advanced training, and that has a direct impact on the ability to handle the level of trauma existing in Gaza. So there's one certified child mental health psychiatrist in there. There are many other psychologists as well as other psychiatrists that are just on the ground working with children but have not received the specialized board training. They do not perform psychological testing there. There's no psychologists that have certified training to perform levels of intellect as well as other types of personality problems. In the past couple years, they've also just started to be able to diagnose using the DSM-4 criteria, which is the Diagnostic Statistical Manual that we use throughout the world to talk about mental health disorders. This creates a huge problem on top of another factor, which is many of the health professionals were also part of Operation Cast Lead, where they were trapped in their house trying to provide support to their community and their children as well. And so now, especially in the mental health community, they're having to go back to work and work with other traumatized families, in addition trying to reconcile their own feelings around the traumatic events that they were exposed to. So this is important to think about as we think about consultation needs for the mental health community. The state of mental health services that we talked about is that there's the Gaza Community Mental Health Program, which has the one certified child psychiatrist and considered the hub of mental health services within Gaza. There's also the Katan Center, which is a located in Gaza City through private donations that has a library and a safe place for children and families to receive additional support around education. The Islamic University, which has a clinical psychology department and a school of nursing department, which is participating in a pilot project with the World Health Organization about advanced training for community-based mental health psychiatric nurses at the master's level. Typically, nurses within the Gaza Strip do not receive education beyond their bachelor's level, which is a great deficit area in being able to provide care. And although the primary care structure is intact, providers and hospitals are not equipped in their training to be able to help support patients that are presenting for somatization of anxiety. So when we talk about continuous traumatic stress, a lot of the research focuses on post-traumatic stress disorder criteria, which by definition states that it's a defined traumatic exposure event followed by an exacerbated response. So the problem that occurs within the Gaza Strip is that due to constant environmental triggering, there really is no opportunity for sustained recovery. So here are some pictures. This is an example of a child that works gathering old concrete salvage from the bombing that occurred in the 3-mile no-fly zone. And so this is what he does on a daily basis. And when I talked to him about his feelings about his job, he views it as something he needs to do, and there's this disconnection about him cleaning up the houses. Another impact is children not having places to play. This was a little girl that we this is one of 1,000 kids that you can see, and this is a typical playground that they would be found in. This is an example of the Islamic University. So some of the buildings have been restructured. However, the building on the right is the laboratory medicine building that was demolished during the Operation Cast Lead. So they have this nice university with greenery, and there's signs of healing, and it's a safe place for education. But then here's this constant daily visual reminder of something that happened. And then another example of beautification attempts through murals with another problem of just environmental pollution, which is a huge problem that they're dealing with there as well. So in conclusion, there are many underlying medical conditions that are exacerbated in this environment due to the impact of limited specialty care, limited mobility, and limited resources. But there's also a lot of direct medical conditions that are exacerbated by the siege. This was kind of a brief introduction where we're just starting to develop some case studies through our work in going to Gaza. We'll also be doing another presentation that'll be a 20-minute presentation specifically focused on environmental toxins through visual methods that we'll be giving on November 2nd. Thank you.